Next talk is Fiona Harrison, who will talk on next generation GRB experiment approaches. 15 minutes time.
Okay, well, I guess the organizers asked me to give this as sort of a projecting what might happen after Swift, presumably because they thought I would still be around then, and unlike Shree, would still be interested in the field. But I have to admit that I'm not that creative, and I can't spend 15 minutes projecting beyond this. So rather, what I'm going to do is try to summarize upcoming capabilities that haven't been touched on much in this conference. Some compliments to HETI 2, Swift, or future Explorer mission, emphasizing, as I said, some of the mission omissions, and then I'll speculate a little bit on what experimental approaches might be interesting after 2006. So this is sort of the centerpiece to give you an overview of what's going to be happening. I think the answer is a lot. I've shown here GRB positioning missions, so missions whose primary objectives are GRB. So we have HETI here in this time frame, and we all hope that we have Swift here in this time frame, but if not, I'm counting on at least having some positioning mission. And you can see then I've got here selected space-based observatories that have relevance to GRBs as well as ground-based things. And so I just want to sort of go through these. The first thing you note, as George Ricker pointed out, coincident with the launch of HETI, we have a large number of very capable X-ray missions that will be coming online. So I want to say a little bit about what I think might be interesting there. And that's the X-ray spectroscopic capability. At early times, many people have pointed out that this is unlikely to be terribly interesting. Any features will be very broad and difficult to interpret and probably diagnostically not so interesting. But at late times, sort of hours to days, you might see weak absorption features of through the interstellar medium, or if in particular, it's been pointed out by Mazaros and Reese and others that if there's a high-density material around the burst, you might see emission features due to either collisional excitation or, say, reflection off of dense material, a fluorescent spectrum like you see in AGN. And this can be used to probe the geometry of the environment. And I point you to a paper by Perls et al. Where they've discussed how you might distinguish between, for example, collisional excitation or fluorescence, and use this to determine the total mass of, say, iron, if that's the line you're seeing, the total mass of material and the density. And they also point out that this requires very high resolution, much better than CCD resolution, as well as large collecting area. But that's okay, because we have a beautiful suite of spectrometers that are going to be launched in the next few years. I've shown here effective area versus energy for the dispersive spectrometers on XMM and AXAF, as well as the calorimeter on ASTRO-E. And you can see that over a broad range of X-ray energy, we're going to have very good resolving power. This is E over delta E. The sort of CCD resolution we're used to is sort of down here somewhere. So we really are entering the golden age of X-ray spectroscopy, or some might say at least crawling out of the prehistoric muck. So this, I think, is something we have to look forward to. Let me just also say, what are the prospects then actually for doing these observations? Well, I think it all depends on what we find. There's now about six TOOs approved for AXAF. They're advertising 24-hour response time. If we see features and if they turn out to be interesting, then we can project maybe 60 over the mission life. If there's no features and it sort of reduced to just measuring X-ray decay curves. I can imagine they'll give up after a few. But XMM is now officially advertising 8-hour response and 10 to 12 per year. So one might imagine getting 100 observations over the mission life. Another interesting prospect, I think, for X-rays is the possibility that these missions can get arc second positions for GRBs that have no radiation at any other wavelength. So that's another upcoming observational prospect, I think, that's of interest. So then going to UV optical IR, obviously in the heady time frame, a lot of the action is going to happen on the ground because you need this for the transient localization and also to monitor light curves and broadband spectra. But I would argue that even for SWIFT, which has, we've just heard, incorporated a UV optical monitor, this is going to continue to be very important. So there's two types of response. There's rapid response robotic telescopes that can respond in sort of times less than 100 seconds, like ROTSI, GROSI, and TARO, and coordinated sort of intermediate size networks. I'm going to focus a bit on this. I think these are going to be very important for HETI, but also very important for SWIFT too, because as has been emphasized in the first few days of this workshop, the red and IR coverage is very important. And it also gives you the ability to adjust instrumentation and your strategy as we learn more about bursts. Now, of course, SWIFT is using existing instrumentation, and the filter, you know, filters have to be designed in the next year. HETI's going to tell us a lot, and we can add capabilities like polarimetry and other things if they become interesting. The challenge, of course, then, is to go from the sort of typical six per year numbers that we're getting now from BepoSACS to one per day, and the current mode of operation to, now I don't mean to sound too derogatory here, but something that's reliable, that has standardized photometry and reliable spectroscopy. So I think this will be important to develop. And in fact, people are starting to think hard about how to do this. And one approach that we at Caltech are thinking about, but also that has been proposed by the British, is a concept where you have six 2-meter telescopes sort of uniformly spaced in longitude, north and south also, and these are fully robotic, and GRBs would be just one part of a larger science aim for a network like this. But it was interesting for GRBs just to look at what sort of what could this do? What fraction of GRBs could you actually get on with what sort of response time? So I did a Monte Carlo saying, all right, let's take these sites. They're, for example, take typical weather conditions and downtime and say, all right, if you have a trigger rate of one a day, how many and light curves that are consistent with current OT observations, then what fraction could you detect, assuming that your trigger is just your GRB trigger is sort of uniformly generated over the sky? And the answer is you can get very good efficiency, 72%. Now, note I haven't factored in here anything for what fraction of GRBs actually have OTs, but at any rate, within an hour, you get on to about half of them. All right. Now, a concept like this, it was proposed already by the Brits, I think, for £19 million, so it's fairly expensive, and you could project that it'll be several years until funding and development of such a concept happens, and it'll probably also involve a fairly large consortium. But to try to make this happen, we're pushing a project that we have a small amount of private funding for called REACT, really excellent astronomers with coordinated telescopes. Now we actually wanted really coordinated astronomers with excellent telescopes, but that was too hard to arrange and we couldn't pronounce it. So we're going with this. And this is sort of the faster, cheaper approach.
So now that you have the telescopes, where are you going to find the astronomers?
Well, that's a good question. We're working on that. So anyway, the concept here is to support existing sites and have standardized references and reduction, and then to provide uniform instrumentation at selected sites based first on multiband cameras, which can greatly enhance the efficiency and quality of these observations, and then later expand to polarimetry and spectroscopy. So a lot of people have been rather skeptical that you could actually extend this concept and get it to operate with high efficiency at burst rates that we expect from SWIFT, which are about one a day. So as a sort of feasibility demonstration, then we wrote to a lot of astronomers and said, all right, at small telescopes, and said, all right, how many nights, if we were to support you with small amounts of funding and a promise of developing instruments in the future, how many nights would you provide with sort of priority interrupt status for GRBs? All right, so this just sort of shows the network, and based on their responses and the number of clear nights they claim to have at their observatories, I did a Monte Carlo calculation similar to the one I described before, and it shows you can actually get, if this all works and you can coordinate it, 80% coverage with more than three observations, independent observations, 75% of the time, more than half within the first hour. So anyway, this is something that I think needs to be developed, obviously pushed for HETI, but I think also in support of SWIFT. Now, I'll just say briefly, we also have a lot to look forward to in terms of deep spectroscopy and host galaxy studies, because there's more than a gigadollar of new 8 to 10 meter class telescopes coming online in the HETI SWIFT era, including Keck Adaptive Optics, Magellan Subaru, Gemini, VLT, to name a few. Sorry? Yes, I should have put dot, dot, dot. Right. And HST, I think it's encouraging that accepted for this year were 12 observations to do studies of galaxy morphology for GRBs, three of which will be FAST, where they define FAST as less than 3 week follow-ups to get OT offset positions. And this is a large increment over the number that were done last year. So as long as GRBs get a lot of publicity and stay above the fold, STSCI will probably continue to do this. Okay, so in the last couple minutes then, I just want to go into, one thing I skipped over, which is worth mentioning, is GALAX. GALAX is a UV mission, and this is sort of an interesting possibility that you can see will go into an extended mission phase right here, sort of in the middle of the SWIFT era. And they are very interested in using this, extending their galaxy survey by pointing at GRB positions, and they can get UV spectra, Lyman break redshifts for OTs and hosts this way. So this is also an interesting capability. So finally then, let's speculate what might be interesting post-2006. Well, I thought about this, and I was reduced to what my philosophy professor always used to tell me was the weakest form of argument, and that's argument by analogy. But let's just assume that the GRB field evolves the same way or as supernova and AGN, and that after this era, we've got some basic consensus about what the progenitors are, as we think type 1As are thermonuclear nuclear detonation of a white dwarf, although we don't have any direct evidence for that. We sort of have a general consensus. We might, the same way, have a general consensus that GRBs arise from hypernovae or some arise from merging neutron stars, etc. The afterglow mechanism, well, it's a complicated non-thermal mechanism with that's going to take a lot of work, so being a little pessimistic here, we could be where we are with the pulsar emission mechanism and slogging away many years later, but who knows. However, given this, GRBs are still going to be interesting to study, just as supernovae and quasars are, because one, you can study the extremes, the faintest, most distant ones, as Ralph was talking about, and the brightest, where you might actually hope to do interferometry, VLBI, get very good diagnostics, and use them as physics laboratories to detect neutrinos and gravity waves. And what you might want in this time frame, then, is huge telescopes, optical, IR, UV coverage with a trigger. Now, if you have to promise the administrator this is all going to cost less than $500 million, probably you're going to do this by having an optimized gamma ray trigger and using existing facilities. So what might you want your gamma ray trigger to look like? Well, let's just quickly go through this. A high rate, if you can get to much more than one a day, then observations on large facilities need not be pre-scheduled. You can go to your telescope and say, all right, I'm going to study the three or four GRBs that went off today. Arc second positions in the gamma ray, well, one might project, of course, that you may not want this, but if it turns out that in some scenarios, if you have neutron star mergers that escape from galaxies and go off in low density media and you have a GRB with no afterglow, then you're going to want to position them and correlate them with galaxies, in which case you're going to need to go from the few arc minute positions of Swift in the gamma ray to arc seconds. Immediate dissemination, that's a given. All sky coverage to optimize the detection of bright GRBs instead of sort of looking at a few steradians. You're going to want to find the brightest ones by covering the whole sky. Broad band to several MeV over a wide field of view, as Ralph was talking about day before yesterday, because you're going to want to do K corrections over a broad redshift range, detect precursors, classify by spectral hardness, all those good things, and then be sensitive enough to probe the entire population. Well, how sensitive is that? I don't know. It could be that Swift sees the edge of the distribution. It could be they don't. So we'll just have to wait and see. So I'm going to leave you with the summary, which is just this view graph again, which should be encouraging. Because if we did have a trigger up in this time frame, you'll note we have very, very large area X-ray spectroscopy. We have NGST. We have the millimeter array and the upgrade of the VLA coming along. LIGO 2, which if anyone asks, I can give you the party line on. And Ice Cube coming up all in this time frame. So the potential to study the most distant, the faintest, and the brightest objects is going to be there. So that's it.